Welcome to Unleash Your Impact, Unlock Others, a podcast about inspiring leadership. We hope to bring you grounded wisdom, stories from real leaders, and leave you feeling inspired. Let's dive in. Hi, this is Dave Morris from Unleash Your Impact, Unlock Others. You're about to listen to a Voices of Leadership episode with Seb Shepherd. Now, when we were editing this episode, we realized that with about an hour and a quarter's worth of material, there was a huge amount of insight and experiences that Seb was talking about. We felt this time we would release this episode in two parts. So what you're about to listen to is part one, where Seb talks about his early life, his experiences in the Navy. And then after that, part two, we'll move on to his time at the Alpine F1 team. So grab yourself a coffee and listen to part one. Thank you. Now, today I'm joined by somebody with an extraordinary story, Sebastian Shepherd. Now, Seb grew up in Chile, served as a Royal Navy helicopter pilot, worked in aerospace and consulting, and then as engineering manager at the Alpine F1 team. And we have Rich here in the background, and Rich is very excited about the stories you've got about F1. So across these experiences, Seb has had, one theme stands out: high performance isn't just about technology or about tactics, it's mostly about people. So in this episode, we'll uncover what Seb has learned about trust, adaptability, and building elite teams in some of the most demanding environments on Earth. So without any further ado, Seb, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you here.
Lovely to be here. Yeah. Thank you.
So should we start at the beginning, Seb? You grew up in Chile. I'm really interested to understand what that experience was like. But more importantly, how did it shape your outlook on life and leadership?
So growing up in Chile was really quite interesting. I mean, at the time, my parents were expats out there, and they never really came back to England. We used to come for holidays and things. So I ended up growing up in a country. I was speaking two languages, living in Santiago, surrounded by mountains, really gorgeous. But at the time, you don't really appreciate it.
No.
Because you know it's there. You know, you think that everybody's got mountains, and we were living a reasonably comfortable lifestyle. You know, my dad was working for a foreign firm and so on. But I grew up there. I ended up sort of going to an English school, and where you sort of spoke English and Spanish, and sort of learnt at a fairly high level. And after school, I ended up going to Patagonia. But growing up, it only sort of became more apparent after I left Chile, whereby you understand that you are, because you've grown up sort of almost bridging two cultures,
yeah,
English at home, Spanish on the streets of school with my friends and so on, is that you're constantly thinking in two languages. And people often ask me, what language are you thinking? I don't really know, because, you know, it just comes out, you know, kind of quite easily switch from one language to another.
Okay.
And I'm constantly amazed as to, I could be talking right now about a topic I don't know anything, I've never spoken about in Spanish, but I can translate directly into that language. But what it does end up teaching you a little bit is about the fact that bridging two cultures means also that you have to translate not only the words, but also the sentiments, the feelings, the way that people think and act in that culture. So they might be telling you something that that you think you're getting the message, but actually what they're telling you is something completely different. I mean, your listeners probably are quite aware of the American English divide, where mm-hmm. where we all say something in English and mean something completely different, and the American culture would go like, yeah, they're really on for this, and actually, you know, what you've just told them is completely the opposite.
Yeah.
So it's kind of you're growing up with that sort of element where you start understanding the other person. So when you're in a room in the future, in my future life, when you're in a room full of different cultures and people, you can actually almost help steer the conversation in a slightly more diplomatic way than to avoid the problems down the road where they're like, no, you told me this. No, I meant something else. And then they never want to be rude to your face, but they want to tell you what you want to hear. But at the same time, you have to bring that out by understanding their culture, by understanding what drives them.
Were you, as a young child, were you aware that you were probably more culturally aware of your surroundings than people maybe who hadn't grown up with, you know, two languages? And
No, not at all. I mean, at the time, you know, I was just a kid growing up speaking, yeah, two languages, and I was lucky enough that my this, we're talking about the 60s and 70s. So for those of you listening who understand the Chilean history, the end of the 60s and the early 70s was a socialist government that got overthrown by a guy called General Pinochet. Yeah. And we had military dictatorship for a while. And in those days, trying to get anything was almost impossible. And the family, the company that my dad worked for, used to import all the whiskey, marmalade, guns, gin, and jets and all sorts of things from the UK into Chile. So by importing all the whiskey, my dad became actually pretty much, you know, everybody's mate. And so therefore we always had the house absolutely full to the rafters every Friday, you know, where everybody used to turn up for whiskey at my house. And it generally meant that you had lots of really interesting people in the house. And me growing up talking to very, very, you know, top people from all walks of life, either visitors or from the government or from, you know, heads of industry and whatever. And, you know, I thought everybody's house always has all these amazing people turning up, but you're just talking to them. So you end up having these amazing conversations with people. And it sort of only becomes apparent when later on in life, when you actually see that the reality is that you don't always come across all these amazing people.
No, and also what strikes me from that story is that what an amazing grounding in how to communicate and have conversation at a very young age, because, you know, not all people in their younger years get that opportunity, do they?
Oh, indeed. I often see it as a huge privilege. And in, you know, years later, when I was doing various things in the Navy and so on, I'd turn up to a foreign port and the most amazing people would turn up because my dad had contacted them and said, look, do you mind inviting them onto the cocktail party on board the aircraft carrier? And they'd turn up and they were like chairman of Shell or some equally amazing thing like that.
Yeah, brilliant. What sort of values did your parents instill in you from that young age that really you could see you've carried through from when you were a young man?
I don't know. I think it's about being able to talk to anybody, being able to be open to ideas and thoughts, wanting to go out there and try different things. I didn't really break into that until I was coming towards the end of my time at school.
Oh, okay.
I didn't particularly like school. It was it was tough time for me, but as soon as I left school and I went to Patagonia, I came across these most amazing people from all over the world, all walks of life, and all very very motivated. And at that point, I started to feel that actually there's some amazing people out there that you know that I can really sort of feel the energy, and I want to be part of that.
Yeah.
So you know, as they say, that you know, surround yourself with people that are better than you. You'll rise to their level and maybe even beyond, but it will make you a better person.
So I think when we first spoke, you said it was about age 17 that you were joining these expeditions in Patagonia. I'm really interested in what experiences that you had there. What did that teach you for your later leadership roles?
So the context is that, you know, having grown up in Santiago, you know, middle class house type thing, you know, never really had any worries about anything. Never really had any proper camping, outdoorsy experience. Suddenly, I'm going from that to Patagonia to a 3-month expedition called Operation Rally. For those of you who might have that long memories,
I remember that.
And this guy, amazing guy called John Blashill Snell, who's still a good mate of mine, fabulous explorer. And anyway, so you turn up. There's about 180 people from all over the world. Everything from, you know, military, SAS, Delta Force type people through to civilian glaciologists and PhDs and this and that and the other, and lots of motivated young people my age from all over the world.
Wow.
And you were there to do all sorts of sort of scientific, community and adventure programs. And suddenly, literally within a few days, I go from nice, comfortable house to being on a fishing boat, which is about, I don't know, 20 foot long, something like that. And there were about 7 of us in there, plus a local fisherman, rowing and sailing about 300 miles south through the Patagonian canals, which is gorgeous, until you get to the point that we didn't really have any proper sort of cover. We used to have to use the sails of the boats in order to with the masts and the oars. I can't really explain this on a podcast, but to make it kind of like half sort of teepee in order to be able to sleep under. And this is kind of semi-permeable sails, and the sails were made out of sacks of flour.
Wow.
And so, and on top of that, I was completely unprepared. So I turned up. Everybody else had these four-season sleeping bags and Gore-Tex jackets and all this. I had literally a wind cheater and a summer sleeping bag. And so this is my first experience of Patagonia. And like my sleeping bag is soaked every night. I'm freezing to death. On top of that, the one nice jacket I had other than this wind cheater was a Dunlop jacket that my dad had lent me, which got washed away by the tide because I was stupid enough to leave it on a rock. So suddenly I'm there. I'm all your creature comforts, all your safety nets, everything is taken away from you.
Yeah.
And also the fact that I'd grown up with basically I was a very fussy eater.
Oh, okay.
And suddenly I go like, well, I either eat all these dehydrated rations that they brought and whatever we could catch, fish, or basically they take me home in a box. And I very quickly learned, you know, all these sort of things. But anyway, I sort of found my tribe because you could tell that you were doing something amazing.
Yeah.
And you were meeting interesting people, and there was energy, and you could sort of feel that, and together you were accomplishing amazing things. And, you know, rowing your way down 300 miles of Patagonian canals is not easy. And then we ended up in this lake in the south of Chile in the classic called San Rafael, and where we spent about a month basically walking up and down the glacier and doing some expeditions out there and things. So I'm suddenly on the North Patagonian ice cap, a huge 200 kilometer long ice cap with lots of glaciers and things, just doing these incredible things. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I could tell that this was amazing. And because of the people that you were meeting, you could tell that they were on a higher plane. I thought, like, this is where I want to be. I want to be like these people. I want to do amazing things.
So a little bit of a fire underneath you in terms of
very much.
Rich and I often talk on the podcast about the importance of, particularly when you get to senior leadership roles, and we'll come on to the roles that you've done a bit later, but obviously resilience and mind management, you know, is really important. Self-awareness is really important. I'm guessing just from listening to those amazing things that you were doing then, that was your first real lesson in resilience and self-awareness and mind management.
Yeah, I mean, it was, to a degree, but I was saying that I had a comfortable lifestyle, but, you know, we did have our issues growing up, and I also did have to learn a little bit of resilience there. But the one thing that you do learn is that, you know, you can have inner resilience, as in, you know, I need to tough this out on my own.
Yeah.
But at the same time is that if you surround yourself with other people, there's almost a collective resilience. Nobody wants to give up. Everyone wants to help each other along. And this is why it's often easier to do, for example, you know, to do a marathon when you've got hundreds of people around you, because everybody cheers you on.
Yeah.
You know, it's easier to go and do exercise. Like I do boot camp in the middle of a playing field in Newbury, even in the depths of winter, with people, because I choose to do that instead of doing it at home, because I know that I'll probably only get done about, you know, 20 sit-ups at home, but I'll do 300 with my mates.
Yeah.
And it'll be cold and it'll be wet and it'll be horrendous and muddy, but you know what, it feels so much better because you are accomplishing things, and that's part of the whole resilience.
And I know I alluded to it in the intro, but obviously, you know, the thing that really you want to talk about today is, you know, is the power of people. I'm guessing that there's a good example from your early life where actually you realised you can achieve so much more if you get a bunch of people all rowing in the same direction. And
exactly, yeah. Exactly. If you've got a common purpose,
yeah,
and you've got good people around you, you know, you can achieve amazing things. And this was, and again, you know, now that I've had time to revisit it, this is. You could tell that was a good basis from which a lot of things came out in my life in the future, is the fact that, you know, there were these I always try and surround myself with good, positive people. As soon as I come across negativity, if that negativity is continuous and you can't change it, you just walk away from that because that's just going to drag you down.
Yeah.
Positive people always drag other people up.
Yeah.
Negative people always drag other people down.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously from there, what was the next step on the ladder for you?
So my initial bit of Patagonia was all about being surrounded by these people, and I was fairly young at the time, 17. And then this chap, John Blasher Snell, the explorer, asked me to stay on as a member of staff, okay. Which in those days was quite unknown, because you had to be 25 minimum to be a member of staff, but I was 17 at the time.
Wow.
But so he asked me to do that, initially a translator, and then sort of I ended up organizing the expeditions for him. And that in those days, I was thinking, oh my God, you know, I can't even drive. and this guy, who is a famous explorer, I mean, this guy invented whitewater rafting.
Yeah.
In the Blue Nile in the 70s, and you know, I was literally having dinners with him and some of his other people, thinking like, oh my God, I'm within expedition royalty here, and so I'm feeling it, and the fact that he's empowering me to go off and do things, and not just being sort of nitpicky or just like, you know, go and you know, always intervening every 5 minutes. He's like, no, I want you to go and do this, Seb. Off you go.
Well, he must have seen some qualities in you, you know, given that you weren't 25, that he thought this young lad is going to be a great leader. What did he ever articulate to you why he chose you at that early age?
No, he didn't. But I mean, you've got to bear in mind that this guy started Operation Drake First and Operation Rally, which is all about empowering young people to be leaders of the future.
Right.
And that's something that, you know, anybody who's ever been on these expeditions, ask them, and they'll say that was probably one of the most amazing things they've ever done in their lives. Mm-hmm. Tim Peake, he always talks about Operation Rally. He was up in Alaska, mm-hmm. And he said that was one of the most transcendental things that happened in his life, because it empowered him, it taught him how to leadership and so on. And in those days, you know, I was finding myself, you know, having to. You know, I wasn't fully in charge of the whole thing because I was obviously too young. But I was very influential, and I could do things. And I suddenly found, you know, actually this responsibility thing is actually scary, but it's, you know, it's good. And you can start seeing that it's not about being afraid of the darkness ahead of you.
Yeah.
But as you take steps further on, it becomes lighter.
Yeah.
And you open doors. And you open doors and it becomes lighter, and you see the room and you go like, oh, actually, that was not nearly half as scary as it was. But and if it is too scary, okay, you walk back and you move somewhere else. But it's about trying. It's about, you know, trying things.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that are leaping at me already in terms of just listening to you there. One is we need to empower people and trust them. And the sooner we do that, the better. You know, why hold back? Because I don't think inside businesses sometimes we do enough of that by any stretch. The other thing is just be open-minded and go and try things. And what's the worst that could happen? Yeah, we're going to make mistakes in a work context, aren't we? We're going to make mistakes in a work context. But as long as you learn from those, I'm sure there. As you said, you couldn't predict what was going to come ahead of you, could you? Half the time.
No, exactly. And at the time, I was just literally, you know, there was so much going on that I just sort of took it as it came. Mm. It was only later on when you start reflecting on these things that you start seeing the patterns of what's going on. But anyway, so after doing a couple of periods of that, and I was lucky enough that in between the expeditions, my father sort of. Got bonus for something he was doing. So he said, look, do you fancy going to learn how to fly? I was like, yeah, absolutely. Nobody turns that one down.
Why not?
and it was a time, because I'd been on these expeditions with all these military people from the UK, I'd sort of expressed an interest of maybe going to England to join the armed forces. And they were very complimentary. They said, look, you must try it. So a long process, managed to get an interview with the Navy. They said, yeah, absolutely, come along. And by the way, do you fancy flying helicopters or jets? I went, yeah. And so after all these expeditions, in fact, towards the end of one of the expeditions I'd helped organize, it was November 87, I think it was, and we were coming back from resupplying a group, and we were in this very, very old and knackered Toyota Land Cruiser. I mean, this thing had huge play on the steering wheel. The brakes, you had to pump them before they worked. You only had about three gears, and it was just horrendous. Anyway, I must say I wasn't driving, but we ended up having a very bad accident in that we went in sideways onto a wooden bridge that was over this torrential river, And a bit like sort of Indiana Jones moment where the you start breaking the side of the bridge. I'm trying to sort of paint a picture here for your listeners. But you start breaking the as you're going sideways along this bridge, the front of the car starts breaking the barriers of the bridge. You end up coming to a stop. The car does a proper sort of Hollywood moment, like leaning forwards. I was the passenger on the right-hand side because they drive on the left over there. And I could see the river below. And I thought, and it's life flashes in front of your eyes type moment. And bear in mind, I'm still only 18, 19, I can't remember. Yeah. And thinking like, okay, that's it. The car's going to topple over. It's going to land, you know, roof down on the river. It's going to be crushed. We're not going to get out. And that's it. Okay, I've had a good life. Bye. Anyway, the sort of moment that stops forever and then suddenly it starts bouncing backwards.
Oh, okay.
And that was only because we had a couple of outboard motors in the back weighing it all down. And anyway, so I'll have to show you the picture after this recording because it's quite unbelievable. But anyway, I came out and I had to take a picture because I thought that's the closest I'll probably ever get to dying in my life. I was wrong about that, but
okay. More of that later.
I learned a lot about that because I thought, you know, hang on a second, it's one of these moments like there's got to be a purpose in life. If I've managed to walk away from this, I need to go off and do it.
I was going to ask you about that. At what point in your... Because, you know, Rich and I talk a lot about in leadership, it's great to have a strong sense of purpose. And obviously, you can help your team have a strong sense of purpose. And I know you'll talk about that with your later experiences. But for you as an individual, what stage in your life did you start to get a sense of what my sense of purpose was? Was this the sort of time when that started to emerge? Or
I don't know. I think... I'm not sure I ever had a sort of sense of purpose. I just thought, you know, I want to go off and open as many doors as possible,
right.
Try different things. And doors, you open one door, you go through it, you do things, and then other doors open.
Okay.
And it's about actually getting ahead of yourself to try and open those doors, be that, you know, learning things, experiencing things, meeting people and so on. I mean, a slight side sort of comment, one of the things I tell my kids a lot is that you can go to university, be a PhD in astromechanics or whatever, but you could probably learn more by traveling on your own and meeting people in different walks of life.
Yeah.
And literally with a backpack.
Yeah.
Doing not the comfortable traveling, but the backpack traveling. You're going to learn more about people, cultures, and how to get on with people and resolve situations than anything you'll ever learn at university. And it's along these lines that that I was kind of experiencing everything. I was thinking like, oh my God, I'm so privileged. I've got all these things are beginning to happen, and I'm feeling like I'm in the middle of something really quite interesting. And I'm just going to ride it until somebody works out that, you know, I shouldn't be there, and they sort of send me packing, kind of imposter syndrome type thing.
Yeah.
And anyway, so eventually I sort of, after this crash, literally I get back to, we managed to block the Patagonian highway, the Pan American highway for about 2 days, but we got back and a phone call came from that, you know, the Navy wants you here in 2 weeks. I was like, oh my God. So I quickly had to hightail it back to Santiago, pack as much as I could, go off to England, and join the Royal Navy, which was the beginning of a whole nother experience.
Yeah. So some great early life lessons there. I mean, crikey, those first 18, 19 years makes my life look a bit boring. But no, I mean, what a fantastic learning experience. And probably it did set, you know, a really good sort of starting point from where you're coming from now, didn't it? And all the things you've done in between. So what you then went back to the UK, Royal Navy, helicopter pilot, I think you said to me. So that was the next. So what are the lessons you can remember from doing that role that you know, really resonate with you now in terms of helping other leaders be the best they can be?
So you join Dartmouth, you learn how to march and salute and so on, and then they sort of pack you away as quickly as possible to go learn how to fly.
Yeah.
In those days, you're learning to be an officer and to lead people.
Yeah.
But it's not so much that you're leading troops like in the army. You're learning how to first fly a helicopter, or in my case, helicopters, and others, fighter jets. But in my case, you learn to fly a helicopter, and it's the first 2 years is all about, you know, how to literally coordinate your hands and feet and brain and things. And then you learn how to fight the helicopter. So in my case, it was an anti-submarine warfare helicopter, which is basically chasing submarines around the world, mainly Russians, which has become in vogue again now.
Yeah.
And also sort of doing search and rescue, you know, if you have to and so on. But that's all about, they teach you something called crew resource management, which is a bit of a mouthful. But it's all about trust in people, as in you're basically in a fighting machine, a very big, expensive fighting machine in very dangerous scenarios. That and everybody is trained, is probably some of the best training in the world, the best training in the world, and you're surrounded by people that you can completely and absolutely trust because you know the training they've been through is the best in the world. But at the same time, it's not just that, it's the fact that you're forging teams which are so close and united that they will know you better than your own family do.
Oh, okay.
And this comes from a series of different things. Like, for example, you know, at the initial part of the training, way before we even start flying anything, we even touch an aircraft.
Yeah.
You go on something called survival training.
Yeah.
And this is something that is not far far beyond the stuff that you see on TV, which is the who dares wins. The TV program. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
It's not far off from that. And basically, you're with a group of people that you would normally be with, your air crew and so on. And you sort of simulate as if you've just crash landed behind enemy territory and you have to escape and evade and live off the land and just, you know, skin bunny rabbits and sort of eat gorse and all sorts of stuff. But it teaches you that deep resilience and the camaraderie and the trust in your team and group that, and again, you know, you're in a group, so you're trying to help each other along because some people will have bad days and good days, but you're generally cold, wet and tired. But it actually teaches you that there's your physical endurance, there's your mental endurance, your limits in both of those, and then there's a whole step beyond.
Yeah.
And this is what special forces talk a lot about, is that they'll take you to a certain limit and then beyond.
And beyond.
And so all of that was the preparation for this, because when you're flying a helicopter with people, and the same with many other sort of elite sort of teams, is that you have to have that complete trust, both on the training that the other person has, but also the kind of person that they are, so that everybody makes the right decision. It's all very proceduralized, obviously.
Yeah.
But they are, I mean, you're doing some very, very difficult things, flying off small ships at night in the storm in the North Atlantic at night, you know, as I said, at night, and trying to recover to that is about as dangerous as flying can get.
It's interesting, though, because a lot of people, I think about the forces and think, oh, it's very cold, it's very unemotional. But actually, the way you're describing it, for me, it's all about relationships. It's all about empathy for other people, because, as you said, you have to understand them better than their families do. So empathy, for me, must have been a big part of what you were learning at that point and needing to use.
Yeah. I mean, it's a brutal world, as in you know, the training. They you know, if you fail, you're out. But the whole process of getting you there is that you're being selected from thousands of people. Mm. So there's a fairly good chance that you're going to get through. But the whole point is that you have to have that trust in what the other person is doing. For example, you know, great example that. Where teams work beautifully well. We had to. We were in a NATO exercise in the North Atlantic, and we got a distress call from I think it was a Dutch frigate that they had a chap who had appendicitis, and we had to literally get him off to hospital within the next 8 hours or something like that. And it was raging storm. Normally, you wouldn't go flying in those. I mean, we're on an aircraft carrier, so it's slightly more easier. Mm. But off a frigate, you there's no way we could have landed the aircraft there. No. So we said, right, let's go and give it a go. And I was duty search and rescue, so we went as a crew of four. So captain, as in first pilot, me, second pilot, observer in the back, which would otherwise be known as a navigator. He was the captain, I think, and the air crewman, who's the guy who works the winch and so on. Anyway, we went off to this frigate, dead of night, so you've got no visual references. And this is the thing that is very difficult to visualize, but you've got no visual references. The only visual reference you have is the back end of the ship, which is bobbing up and down, left and right. So it's kind of like it's a cork in water.
Yeah.
And you're trying to sort of hover over this.
Yeah.
Bring the winch down, pick up a chap from there, and then fly him off to. But your blades are flying super close to the superstructure of the ship. So you get this slightly wrong, and everybody's going down 2,000 meters to their watery grave. So here's where the crew resource management comes in, is that the non-flying pilot is giving me instructions of what's happening with the altitude of the aircraft so that my brain doesn't override that thinking, because I'm following the superstructure, that's all I can see.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
through the eyes, it's coming at me thinking that, oh my God, is it getting too high, too low? And I'm trying to, so I'm not trying to chase that, but the non-flying pilot is telling me, okay, you're steady, height, left and right, all this sort of thing. Then the guys in the back are busy trying to make sure that they can winch the guy down, recover the guy down, without sort of people just swinging off the side of the ship. So it's a whole thing of perfect communication. It's almost like a ballet act. Everything comes together beautifully well. And, you know, we got the guy on board, flew him to I think it was Stavanger Hospital, and, you know, he survived. But it was about as close as you can get to, and that's the beauty of it. You come back, everybody sort of goes down to the bar and has a few stiff ones to kind of calm yourself down. But
yeah, and most of us in normal mortals are not going to be in that degree of danger in something of that importance. But I guess the lessons there for me in terms of how you trust other people, the clarity of communication when you're under a lot of pressure, that's something that every business can learn from, isn't it? That's something we all need to be able to do.
I mean, that certainly helped me in the future. In that one thing that's very short of in companies, that companies tend to always end up being driven by focusing on certain things that then, like money, which is, you know, the purpose of all companies is to make money, but is that starts eroding on things like on human capital. And that's the first thing that goes, is that you don't trust people, don't get that, leaders don't get trained properly. And this is kind of my, and I guess your mission too, is that trying to get business to understand that if you find good people and you empower them and you motivate them properly and you give them a good purpose and you look after them and their careers, then they'll give their best for your company. But if you start sort of whittling them down by saying like, oh no, you can't have this, you can't put your expenses in for that, or it's just there's all sorts of barriers to doing things, that there's a toxic atmosphere and so on, then people don't want to work there.
No, and our philosophy is, and I know you share this, we were talking earlier on before we started recording about Daniel Pink's, you know, view of intrinsic motivation. Exactly. Give people autonomy. You know, they know where the boundaries are. Yeah, help them achieve mastery and help them be better at stuff, and give them a sense of purpose.
Correct.
Those three things, I think, no matter what industry you work in, are critical, aren't they?
Yeah.
And you're right. I don't think we train leaders enough, A, to understand that, let alone to give them the skills to make it happen. I think there's a lot of work to be done on that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got... Daniel Pink was the basis of a lot of the stuff I did, especially in F1 with my teams. I can categorically say it works absolutely spot on. And it's all about the human element. And again, some companies get it right, but many companies, they talk a good game and they talk about, you know, cultures and values and behaviors and so on, but they don't actually do it. And leaders are very quick to criticize, there's a toxic atmosphere, as opposed to like, no, there's a toxic atmosphere because leaders allow it to happen.
Mm.
And one of the things I often say is that, you know, you get the culture that you tolerate.
Yes. Yeah.
So that if, you know, if people, if there's a toxic culture or things are not behaving well, doesn't matter whether it's in a team of three or a company of 500, it's the leaders. People always mimic what the leaders are doing, especially one up, two up. And if your leaders come in and say, like, right, these are company values and these are behaviors and I want you all to behave like this, and the first thing that they look at you, they go like, okay, you want us to do this, but you are behaving, and we don't see you behaving that way. We don't see you reflecting those values on a day-to-day basis. We don't see you talking to us with empathy or with interest about our careers and so on. How do you want us to behave like that if you're not even willing to show to give the example?
No, absolutely, Yeah. So how did you go from flying helicopters and all those amazing experiences to high-speed cars? And I know Rich is waiting in the wings. He wants to hear the F1 stories here. Yeah. So how did that transition happen?
Hi, Dave again. So that's the end of part one of the podcast. I hope you've taken away some really great insights from Seb's early life experiences. He certainly paints a vivid picture. In part two next week, he'll be talking about his time at the Alpine F1 team and how much of what he learned in his early life he applied to good effect. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again next week.